music from Spike Jonze's film adaptation of Where the Wild Things Are. Because today on Books and Arts Daily, we celebrate the life of Maurice Sendak, whose work inspired that film. In fact, we celebrate two legends today. We go on holiday with the godfather of rap, Gil Scott-Heron. Do stay with me, Michael Cathcart, to remember these two great lives. Yes, the children's book author and illustrator Maurice Sendak died this week at the age of 83. His books have many fans, including the President of the United States.
That very night, in Max's room, a forest grew and grew and grew until his ceiling hung with vines and the walls became the world all around. And an ocean tumbled by with a private boat for Max. And he sailed off through night and through day and in and out of weeks and almost over year to where the wild things are. Whoa. And when he came to the place where the wild things are, they roared their terrible roars.
Oh, yes, they did. The President of the United States, Barack Obama, reading to a bunch of kids from Where the Wild Things Are. Well, when President Bill Clinton presented Maurice Sendak with America's National Medal of the Arts in 1996, Clinton said that Sendak's books have helped children to explore and resolve their feelings of anger, boredom, fear, frustration, and jealousy. Well, to look at this legacy, I'm joined by John Check. John is Professor of English at the University of Florida. He's a longtime friend of Maurice Sendak and also a scholar of his work. And he's a children's book author and poet himself. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michael.
Maurice was a bit of a rock star, really, wasn't he? He had groupies, but they were children and parents who'd read his work over generations.
Oh, he was totally that. I remember every one of his books we all awaited, like, a Beatles album or a Rolling Stones album, and, wondering what he was going to do next. And it was always something surprising and unexpected. It was really path-breaking for the 1960s because, really, nobody was doing anything like what Maurice was doing. Dr. Seuss had arrived on the scene, of course, and but his books were quite different, as you know, from Sendak's, and his style stayed the same. And he really didn't let the kids own the monsters or the mischief that was being made. The cat makes the mischief. The kids sit around and are rather passive. But with Maurice, it was the little boy. It was Max doing it all.
Yes, they're right in the thick of things. They're either creating mischief or they're in the pie, being cooked up as mischief. You knew him quite well. How did your life intersect with his?
Well, I was at the University of Connecticut in the late 1960s as a grad student, and one of the great courses in children's lit in America was being taught there by Francelia Butler, and she invited Maurice to come speak to this large undergraduate class of 400-plus students that, students were looking in the window and swinging from the chandeliers. You can imagine the scene, and every week she had a different person, and she would have Margaret Hamilton, who played the Wicked Witch of the West and the Wizard of Oz, come in and talk about the making of that film, and she would have Madeleine L'Engle come in and talk about A Wrinkle in Time, and then she had Maurice, and it was just really magical. It was exciting and magical, and it was one of those fertile periods in American children's literature when there was Maurice and Seuss and William Steig and Tommy Ungerer and a bunch of people who were doing simply extraordinary books like we hadn't seen before in America.
Well, you obviously take it very seriously because you've written a scholarly work on the symbolism in Maurice Sendak's work. Did he play a part in you writing that book?
Well, he was very generous. I mean, we were friends. I'd interviewed him a number of times for various magazines and as books would come out. He gave me free rein of his archives at the Rosenbach Museum in Philadelphia. And I asked him if he wanted to see the work as I was writing it. And he said, no, he really insisted that it be my book. He didn't want to say anything that would deflect it or steer it in a different direction. He wanted it to be mine. And I was quite struck by that at the time, that he was that generous and that willing to let a young scholar like myself just, have a go at it, and was very supportive throughout the process. And it turned out, when Spike Jonze came along and was doing the Where the Wild Things Are film with him, he gave him that kind of artistic freedom to do the kind of film that Spike wanted to do. And it was quite extraordinary, because often writers want to keep control of their, their work and not have it be transformed in any unusual or unique ways, like, as the director might have in mind. But he gave Jonze his a carte blanche and let him go. And it's a different work, of course, than the book is.
Which, of course, is the secret to crossing genres. You've got to make it work in the new genre. Had he been fading recently? In health?
I'm sorry. Yeah, he had. I think in the Colbert interview that was aired in this past January. I mean, he was wonderful and crabby and witty, and Colbert had kind of gotten him to talk about celebrity books and how everyone in the world seems to be writing a celebrity children's book. And Colbert came in with this preposterous idea about writing a book about a flagpole and the flagpole's various attempts at finding a role for himself in life, what he could possibly be, and using this as a kind of metaphor for what kids are trying to do in their lives, presumably, imparting a little bit of wisdom from the wise TV star to the children who might be reading the book. And Sendak played along with the joke, and they had a great time, and he even endorsed the book. He said it was so terrible it would probably do very well.
Yeah. That's Stephen Colbert we're talking about. Actually, we've got a link to that interview on our website. Yeah.
It's a wonderful interview, but you could tell Maurice was fading then, and those of us who knew him and had talked with him, had been bracing for this, and you're never quite ready for it, and you certainly don't want it to occur, but you can see that the kind of energy that used to be there, the flow and the rhythm of his language and the way he was able to very craftily and wittily talk about things was starting to diminish, and he was missing a few beats. And so this didn't come as a complete surprise, but it's also, it comes as a very sad day in a lot of lives for people who cared around the world for what he did.
On RN, you're on Books and Arts Daily, and we're remembering the life and work of Maurice Sendak, who died this week and is best known for his book, The Wild Things, or Where the Wild Things Are. And we're talking to his friend, Professor John Check. What was his background? Tell us about where he came from.
Well, he grew up a lower middle-class, working-class kid in a Jewish family. His dad was a tailor and worked in what's called the shmatas business, the rag trade, the garment industry in New York. And he did okay, but they weren't well-to-do by any means, and they lived in a rather spare apartment in Brooklyn. And Maurice, grew up in the inner city and played stoop ball and the games kids play on the streets. He was largely self-educated. He didn't go to art school. And he had begun drawing at a very early age, and he was very, very good, very talented. His older brother and his sister were also interested in the arts. His older brother was a very good artist, Jack Sendak, and introduced art and comics and things like that that became so important in Maurice's life, introduced Maurice to them, to these genres, and Maurice took it from there.
Yeah.
His father was very unhappy about this. He wanted to have baseball-playing kids, who were out roughhousing, and instead he had these kids who were making books and carving toys out of balsa wood and all these other things that no other kids on the block were doing.
But also a kid who was gay. Did his father know he was gay?
No. Maurice very scrupulously hid that throughout his life, most of his adult life. In fact, he just came out about about 7 or 8 years ago publicly. But his parents never knew.
He said that extraordinarily painful line, "All I wanted was to be straight so my parents could be happy."
Right. Right. I mean, that was very, very important to him. I mean, he saw being gay, to judge by the quotes he's left about this, to be a very more of a disappointment. I mean, he wanted to be straight in order to please them, in order to not have the kind of pump in the career and in his life that being gay meant. You know, certainly growing up in the 30s, 40s, 50s in America, I mean, it wasn't easy, and you really had to be really careful about that.
Well, he didn't,
and especially as a children's book writer, he had to be extremely careful about that. I mean, the idea of a gay man, you know, in 1960 or 1970, being a children's book writer.
He did have some happy memories of his childhood. Here's Maurice talking to Terry Gross on the American National Public Radio's program Fresh Air about his happiest memories as a child.
One of the happiest memories I have is when my grandmother would come to stay with us, and she would put me on her lap, and then she used the window shade like a magic lantern. And she'd pull it down, and then I'd hold my breath, and she'd pull it up, and the same thing would be there, a car or my brother and sister making a snowman or whatever. So happy memories are being indoors looking out of windows, and I think it's no accident that windows or children looking out of windows or going through windows or whatever becomes an obsession in most of the books I've written.
There he is, Maurice, talking about windows, which are quite a theme in his books. Before we talk about windows, John Cech, I suppose we should note that if he was born in 1928, then he lives through the Holocaust, and that has a profound influence on him, of course.
Yeah, it touched his family very deeply. In fact, they lost all of their Polish relatives who never did make it to the States, you know, thinking that the whole thing would blow over, that they would somehow escape, and they didn't. And that event became a crucial factor in his life. I mean, it's something he references in book after book after book. He keeps coming back to that throughout his artistic career, in the opera Brundabar that he did with Tony Kushner, in Dear Millie, the book he did about the Brothers Grimm, in based on that Brothers Grimm story, and in We're All in the Dumps with Jack and Guy, you see the little kittens who are stolen by the rats lined up in bunks that are right out of Buchenwald.
Mm-hmm.
It was something that haunted him, just this ominous sense of impending death back there in his family, claiming members of his family. And he had been quite sick as a kid, and so he had this sense, he even heard the doctor telling his parents, you know, that he might not make it through the night. He had scarlet fever. He was quite ill. It was an illness that was claiming a lot of lives at the time, and before antibiotics. And so he had this going on in his own life as well, to mix with the larger tragedy that his family was experiencing as they learned about relatives who were vanishing, you know, in the smoke of the camps.
Where did he learn to draw?
He was self-taught. His brother showed him, started him off, and he imitated his brother. And then they both imitated comics at the time. The Sunday Funnies and daily comics in the newspapers were sort of his launching pad. He drew comics from a very, very early age, especially Mickey Mouse. He loved Mickey Mouse, and several times drew himself as a kind of drew Mickey Mouse as a kind of surrogate for himself or a doppelganger for himself. His imagination was full of Disney and Disney's cartoons, and Disney had also done a lot of comic books during the 1930s, and so Sendek was drawing. One of his earliest drawings is a Mickey Mouse drawing.
And yet the first book of which he's both the illustrator and the writer is Kenny's Window, published in 1956, which looks nothing like comic books. In fact, the illustrations, well, they look a little bit French to me. They're very delicate little, I guess they're ink drawings, are they? They're very beautiful.
Yeah, Yeah. Well, he had the really good fortune of having a superb editor who nurtured him, Ursula Nordstrom, who he was with for over 20 years. And her point with him was not to develop one particular style, a comic book style or something else, I mean, but to try different styles. So throughout the 50s, where he did over 50 books before he did Where the Wild Things Are, and you see him changing from book to book. In one book he's Chagall, in one book he's Winslow Homer, in one book he's Albrecht Dürer.
That's right.
You know, his style is all over the place, and that was her point. She wanted him to, she made sure he got to see exhibits in New York and abroad, and really that he developed as an artist with versatile talent so that he could do anything and do it in different ways. Sue says, you know, I mean, it's the same. I mean, every one of his books, we love his books, but it's the same drawing in every one of them.
Yes, that's
and
great.
And William Steig, grumpy old William Steig. I mean, all of his books are drawn the same way as well.
Yes, on our end, we're remembering the life and work of Maurice Sendak, and I'm talking to his friend, Professor John Cech. Well, let's talk about Where the Wild Things Are, which came out in 1963. It has a reputation as being a bit of a genre breaker. Was it really?
Oh, yeah. At the time, there was nothing like that book on the American picture book scene. I mean, nobody had done a book like that. I remember when I was doing my book about him, I was able to handle the original drawings for The Wild Things, which are in Philadelphia at the Rosenbach, and they bring you a box and lift the illustrations gently out of the box for you, and you peel back the tissue paper, and these things are alive.
Mm.
I mean, they're such extraordinary pictures. And Sendak told me in it that the printing can only get about 60-65% of what's there on the page, what's there in the actual picture. You know, otherwise the book would be so expensive that nobody could afford it. But even at that, you know, it's such an amazing book. We hadn't seen a book like that before. Kids were largely docile. I mean, Dr. Seuss's little kids, as I mentioned, in The Cat in the Hat, they're sitting around while the cat is cavorting. You know, but here comes this kid charging down the steps, chasing his dog with a fork, and pounding nails into the wall, hanging his teddy bear from a clothesline. I mean, it's just, he was doing everything a child in a children's book was not supposed to do, because we're still plugged into that literalist sense of a children's book, that if a kid sees it in a children's book, he'll want to do it.
Yeah.
You know?
So it's not moralistic. I mean, that's what upset people, I suppose. It's not moralistic. This is actually a very naughty boy who goes off and has a really marvelous adventure, just being bad, and he hangs out with a lot of other bad people, actually.
Yeah, and he has fun.
He has a great time.
Yeah, what could be better?
Yeah, it sounds
good. And when we read it, we had, we just had our daughter, and I was reading this book thinking, you know, well, this is what we all want to do. This is what everyone wanted to do in the 1960s. And I asked Sendak about this. I said, did you have any sense that you were predicting what was going to go on in the 1960s in the States, you know, that pretty soon there would be people walking down the streets of every major city in America, and certainly at Woodstock, who looked like your Wild Things, you know, doing what your Wild Things are doing? And, you know, he sort of laughed quietly, you know. He claimed that these weren't, you know, socially involved books, but they were, you know, because he's very much, he when he writes, Sendak always needed absolute silence, but when he drew, I mean, he had music on and TV on and conversations going on with the television and kibitzing and cursing. He was a great curser, Sendak was, and so you can't help but feel that some of the chaos that was beginning to start in the 1960s, the zeitgeist that was blowing across our continent and would blow across the world, I guess.
Well, it's huge in the 1960s, but it's still huge today. Let's meet a new convert.
My name's Lila, and I'm 6 years old. part of the story that I liked best was when they showed the terrible claws and gnashed the terrible teeth. Some bits are scary and some bits are happy.
And how do the happy bits make you feel?
Really happy.
What's a happy bit in this book?
When he becomes king.
Would you like to be a wild thing?
No.
Are you a wild thing?
No.
Would you like to go where the wild things are?
Yes.
Oh, isn't that heart-stoppingly beautiful? That's Maria Tickle, our colleague Maria Tickle, with her gorgeous girls Lila and Ivy.
They're wonderful. This is just so wonderful.
Well, you can download that. Everyone can download that and play it for their friends. You can get it off our website. I mean, there are some very silly people around, aren't there? People who don't get what that book's about. And then I'm reading that there's this lovely book called In the Night Kitchen, which I've seen as an animated version on YouTube just this morning, which is all about a boy called Mickey or Mikey. And there were people who didn't like the fact that he was naked and you could see his little penis. I mean, what is wrong with these
horror.
People?
The horror. Yeah. Oh, yeah, and there were even librarians who drew little diapers on him, little underpants.
Oh, you're joking. They defaced the books.
Yeah, they did. And some put little Band-Aids on him. Oh. And, yeah, they were really just, besides a few, not a lot, but a few were. And it's still on the banned book list here in the States. You know, we still have those things where people fulminate about, you know, what could possibly happen to a child if he saw Mickey's little penis.
Yes. Yeah. This is the story of a kid who gets baked in a great big pie, a great big cake, because the baker seems to think that he's milk. And he's got the great line, "I'm not the milk and the milk's not me." I mean, these lines just enter your childhood, don't they, and don't go away for the rest of your life.
Oh, they don't. They don't ever. You're absolutely right about that.
He had some other fantastic collaborations. One was with Isaac Bashevis Singer.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of the goat. And then he did a group of Singer's fairy tales from the old world. And they're extraordinary. And they're very different. I mean, the style of them is a very different, almost a 19th century style. Mm. He loved Singer, and Singer loved him, and they hit it off famously. And it was Singer's first children's book.
Well, the other thing we've not talked about is the way in which he's inspired other people. And we do have a tape here of the Australian writer and artist. Well, let's hear her. She's been inspired by Maurice Sendak.
My name's Anne James, and I'm primarily a children's picture book illustrator, but I also run a gallery that promotes book illustration of other Australian artists because I'm really passionate about picture books. Some of the picture books that I've illustrated over the last 30 years or so include Lucy Goosey by Margaret Wilde and Little Humpty is by her also. I illustrated a book by Sonia Hartnett fairly recently called Sadie and Rats. I discovered Maurice Sendak probably in the early 1970s when I was first doing art teaching, and my partner is a teacher librarian, and so I just got really involved in the picture books in her library and discovered Where the Wild Things Are and Mickey and the Night Kitchen were my first two ones, I think, that I discovered of his. And then I went back and go into the little book room in the city in Melbourne frequently. I would hunt out earlier books of his, like A Hole is to Dig by Ruth Krauss and others. They're the ones that I really treasure. He, I think, is one of the most important storytellers and story creators of books for children that we've had ever, I think. And all of my contemporaries would probably agree with me, I think, and probably for very different reasons than I have. But my main thinking of him as a treasure is that he was such a wonderful storyteller and had a real rapport with the child in himself, I think.
Anne James there, whose picture books include Lucy Goosey and her illustration of Sonia Hartnett's book Sadie and Rats. And it has been compared to the work of Maurice Sendak. Maurice's friend John Check is with me. John, before we wind up, I do want to tell this story about a fan that Maurice Sendak would tell. He says, a little boy sent me a charming card with a little drawing, and I loved it. I answer all my children's letters, sometimes very hastily, but this one I lingered over. I sent him a card, and I drew a picture of a wild thing on it, and I wrote, "Dear Jim, I loved your card." And then I got a letter back from his mother. She said, "Jim loved your card so much that he ate it." And Sendak says, "To me, that was one of the highest compliments I've ever received. He didn't care that it was an original drawing or anything. He saw it, he loved it, and he ate it." Isn't that fantastic?
Oh, yeah, that's great. That's just great. And that's so, yeah, that really captures Maurice's sense of humor, but it's also his total respect for children, total and utter respect for children and their honesty and their freshness and their vitality. I mean, that was something I thought Anne had talked about that in the clip you ran from her, that's one of the things that he gave us of the many gifts that that come through in his work and his storytelling was that, Spike Jonze called his documentary about Sendak, "Tell Them Anything You Want." But if you watch the end of that documentary, which is very moving, Sendak says, the rest of the quote is, "Tell them anything you want, but tell them the truth."
Mm.
And I think maybe that should be the subtitle of the documentary, but tell them the truth. And it's a very, sort of the essence of Sendak, you know, is that, you know, you tell kids the truth and the stories you write for them, the art you create for them. You don't hold back. You don't, you know, there are limits, but within those limits, and they're very broad and they're very flexible and they're very powerful, you don't hold back. You tell them the truth.
Mm.
And I think that's what he did in book after book.
Well, John, it's been such a pleasure remembering Maurice Sendak with you today. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for asking me.
John Check is director of the University of Florida's Center for the Study of Children's Literature and Culture.